Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 213, AVS senior writer Mark Henninger and I answer questions from the chat room. Coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded July 3rd, 2014. Episode 213, Chat Room Q&A. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is my cohort in crime at AVS Forum, Mark Henninger, the senior writer and social media manager, who is a great help to me and writes a bunch of great stuff on the forum. Hey, Mark, welcome back.
Hey, Scott. Glad to be back on the show.
You bet. Mark and I are just going to be hanging out, answering questions from the chat room today. So if you've got home theater questions or any kind of audio video questions, post them in the chat room. Use one of our screen names. I'm Scott Wilkinson, no spaces, capital S, capital W. Mark is, I believe, iMagic, no caps there, right, Mark?
Right, I-M-A-G-I-C.
Okay, and just post them in there, and if you use our screen name, it comes up in a different color in the chat room, so draws our eye to it. We can find it more easily. And before we start, I just want to say that those of you who are tuned in can ask questions, because that's the whole point of this show. So we actually already started before the show began. So let's go back to a couple of those questions real quick. One of which was about DSD. Direct Stream Digital. This is the digital audio format that is used by the physical disc known as SACD, and it's also now available as a download format. It's one of what are called the high resolution audio formats, which typically means better performance, better sound quality than CD is capable of. Mark, do you have much experience with DSD or SACD, or have you spent much time with those formats?
I tried to get into it when SACD came out because I've always been interested in multi-channel audio, and that was one of the things that the format promised. My current opinion on DSD kind of aligns with the cynics who say that its impenetrability is what made it appealing to record companies. In studios, nobody is mixing and mastering on an all DSD workflow anyway. So it's a format that you have to convert a project into at the end. And then what you basically do to it is make it more difficult to play back, more difficult to copy. And you create a market for specialized players. That's my take on it.
I mean, certainly you can record in DSD, and there are plenty of projects that are recorded directly to DSD, but there are very few tools available to edit, mix, process in a DSD format. And so the DSD files, the data, needs to get converted into good old PCM that we know and love from CDs and higher resolution formats than that. So, you know, I don't see a lot of need for it. I also, as I said at the beginning, before we started the show, there are those who argue, well, let me first explain a little bit about how DSD works. It's a digital sampling format, but instead of sampling the waveform in 16-bit chunks or 24-bit words, it samples in 1-bit words, but really, really fast, much faster than PCM. So DSD, the basic sampling rate is 2.8 megahertz or mega cycles, whereas in PCM it's 44 kilohertz or 96 kilohertz up to 192 or even 384 kilohertz. That's a lot less than 2.8 megahertz. but it only has one bit resolution. And so there's a process whereby there's a bunch of noise that actually gets generated, and what that gets all pushed out beyond 20 kilohertz, just beyond 20 kilohertz. So my understanding goes, and if someone can correct me, then that's great. I'm always interested in increasing my knowledge. But anyway, if all the noise gets pushed out just beyond 20 kilohertz, then you have good, clean, low noise content up to 20 kilohertz, which is the music. And then above 20 kilohertz, you have a bunch of noise. So the question of whether or not that's really a high resolution file is a legitimate question, because it doesn't go out beyond 20 kilohertz. Whereas, for example, 96 kilohertz, 24-bit PCM can go out to 48 kilohertz, presumably, and have a very wide dynamic range. So that is a question. Now, DSD sometimes is captured at twice that sampling rate, 5.8 megahertz, which means that the noise gets pushed out twice as far as it did with the lower sampling rate. So that could, in fact, be considered high definition or high resolution. All of these questions swirl around, and as Mark said, it's a kind of an impenetrable format. I forget who it was who said they were downloading their first DSD. Please do, and give it a listen and see what you think. Mark, you were about to say something?
Well, my thought on DSD is that it was meant to appeal through description to lovers of analog music, that it somehow traced the curve of the waveform more like a needle in a record somehow, because there were fewer steps because of the higher sampling rate. But at least my understanding of PCM is that those stair steps don't really exist in the translation, which is why actually 1644 audio can sound extremely good, and that basically the bit depth only really translates into a noise floor dynamic range.
Correct.
Now DSD, you know, by making the bits go by so quickly, you can say that it basically has a higher, it's higher resolution in that theoretical sense. Yeah, in some sense, but it doesn't actually translate into a higher maximum frequency or a tangibly higher, you know, dynamic range than just using high bit PCM. And that's, I think, been well proven. So to me, it's much more elementary. Computers are powerful. Most stuff is being produced in the studio at 2496 PCM, 24192 PCM. And it's relatively easy to deliver that, or to deliver it as 1648 with a very simple, you know, reduction and a bit of dithering. You know, I mean, the science behind that is pretty well proven. So, we're talking about DSD, it's almost like we're dredging up what we thought of a long time ago before we had computers that could just handle high bit PCM. Now when you watch a Blu-ray, you know, it's going to be 2448 or 2496 multi-channel audio, and everybody that I know thinks it's the best, you know, and that there would be really no reason to have some alternate format that attempts to actually be better than that, since it just all exceeds what human senses could stand if it was actually reproduced in full. Even 2496, it's just beyond.
Well, 2496, I think, is probably the edge of what I would consider reasonable. Some people go out to 192 kilohertz sampling rate, even 384, and I think that's not necessary. Another point you brought up that I wanted to just touch upon is that there are quite a few audiophiles who treasure analog audio, and as you say, I think one of the appeals of DSD for them was that it possibly more closely approximated what analog did. You and I both attended this high-resolution audio listening experience at CE Week in New York. And there were, you know, a couple of people there who were recording still on analog tape and then digitizing that in one way or another. But I was particularly interested in Frank Filippetti. Were you in the room when Frank Filippetti was talking?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. You were probably out munching or talking with somebody, but that recording studio, the control room where they held the actual listening event, was very small. But Frank Filippetti made no bones about the fact that he hates analog. He just hates it. He said it's not a flat medium. It's got all kinds of distortions that you have to deal with. So he was just, analog stinks. Digital's great.
Absolutely got the end of that.
That was really funny.
Yeah.
I thought that was really funny. Okay, so Shivers in the chat room is asking, I'm looking for a decent DAC, a digital to analog converter, below $1,500. Any input about that? Perhaps how to come to a decision? I haven't spent a lot of time with DACs myself. Have you, Mark?
I don't, because I believe that AVRs do everything I need. I mean, if we're talking about a portable DAC, then sure, that would be another topic. But for home use, a dedicated DAC, I'll skip it.
Okay. Well, them's fighting words to many people. So watch out for the comments you might get on that one. I personally don't have a lot of experience with them either. So I'm going to have to defer to a couple of other websites. I will say that innerfidelity.com, which is Tyle Hertzen's website, and he specializes in headphones, but they also deal a lot with DACs, digital analog converters. There's the Benchmark analog to digital digital to analog converter, the DAC 1 and DAC 2, but those are in the $5,000 range. Maybe somebody in the chat room will have a good suggestion for a DAC in the under $1,500 range. Web 1003 in the chat room is asking, any thoughts on Burr Brown DACs in vintage CD players? Burr Brown is a brand, if you will, of chip that is installed in many different types of audio devices, and generally very, very well regarded. So I would say I have nothing bad to say about them. I think they've gotten a ton of great press, and so those guys are they know what they're doing. Also, earlier in the chat room, somebody called for a moment of silence for plasma from Samsung. Mark, you wrote this week that Samsung is getting out of the plasma business. This after at CES, somebody asked them about, are you going to stay in the plasma business now that Panasonic is out? And they said, oh, yeah, we'll be doing it for 10 more years. Took them, 6 months, and they've said, okay, we're done.
Yeah, they made similar statements to me last year when they were unveiling their OLED television, which is also done because Samsung is
kind of done.
Yeah, well, it's for Samsung, it's done. They don't have anything new coming out, as far as I know. And that they also announced that they're putting that on pause, although not presumably killing it forever. Now, I do wonder what's going to happen to the plasma fabrication facilities. Is all that stuff really going to be mothballed, put in a dump, or is a Chinese company going to take a shot at
it? Yeah, good question. I don't know. Certainly, I can't imagine they would just scrap it. I mean, it's infrastructure. They should be able to retool it for 4K LED TVs, don't you think?
Of course, a bending factory, right?
A bending factory, yes. like Bender over my shoulder here. Somebody was asking me if I was going to bring the Bender robot with me to Petaluma this weekend, which I'm not.
What really killed plasma is you can't bend the screen.
And somebody here in the chat room, NLE guy, said, so no 4K plasma ever? And I think the answer is no, never. I don't think they're going to do it. There was at least one 4K plasma made by Panasonic some years ago. It was 152 inches.
the smallest plasma that you can make, it would have to be twice that dimension to be 4K. Basically, the cell size had a practical limit. So, you can make a 42-inch plasma, I think. So an 84 would be the smallest conceivable 4K plasma, and it would consume so much electricity that governments would ban it. it's a
good
fact.
Point.
They wouldn't be able to be sold in Europe or presumably in California. You know, just, yeah. The already automatic brightness limiting was an issue with them, and you can only imagine. Yeah, I mean, yeah, why Plasma's so, never made it. Yeah, made it past 64 inches in the home use.
Well, yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, except for those professional Mega Plasmas.
There were some professional ones at 82, I think, and 102 Panasonic made, and this big 152, which you would have to basically build your house around.
Yeah.
Anyway, Twilight Linkable is asking, I have an issue with my Pioneer sound system. From time to time, my digital input is not in sync with my TV when I'm watching cable, but when I switch to Blu-ray, everything is fine. For the cable box, I'm having to use a different audio input to fix the issue. Is there a way I can prevent myself from using two different inputs and have everything on just the digital input? I guess, okay, so the Pioneer sound system is separate. Is it like an AVR and speakers? Is that what the deal is? And it's only from time to time, which is kind of odd. And my one other question would be, when you switch to Blu-ray, everything is fine. When you switch then from Blu-ray back to the TV input, is it out of sync? I'd need to know more about how it's connected in order to see if I can answer that question. So post something about exactly what's connected to what, and I'll see if I can help you with that. Web 10.03, what would be my dream vintage two-channel stereo setup? Well, that's a loaded question because I'm not really a two-channel guy. I think, like Mark, I'm more of a multi-channel music guy. I prefer multi-channel music when it's well-mixed and well-recorded. For two-channel, I've never considered myself a real audiophile because, well, for one reason, I'm a live musician. I'm a professional musician, and I play live gigs all the time. And so no amount of money is going to get me a system that can replicate that experience, that can, you know, come close to that experience, really. There was only one time when I was fooled. It was a stereophile hi-fi show years ago in a hotel, and I was walking down the hotel corridor, and I heard some music coming out of one room. I mean, music coming out of every room. But this one room, the music was coming out. And I remember so clearly my thought was, what are they doing with live musicians in there? They weren't live musicians, of course. It was Wilson Audio speakers, which probably at the time were like $150,000 a pair, mated with reasonably esoteric electronics as well. And, you know, coming through the crowd in the hotel room and out into the hallway, it in fact fooled my ears. So I guess I would have to say, sure, a pair of Wilson speakers with the right electronics driving them. I just heard, Mark and I both just heard the JBL M2 Master Series monitors. Those are about $25,000 a pair, which is cheap compared to the Wilsons, but they really sounded great too. Mark, what would you say? Have you heard any two-channel systems that really knocked your socks off?
Did he ask about vintage and is vintage 80s?
That's a good question. He did say vintage, and I wonder if that means tubes.
Yeah, see, if it just means a few decades ago, then yes, Wilson, I think Grand Slams, powered by some old-school Krell amps, that was my dream. System, and sure, I would love to visit what that, you know, roughly like the turn of 1990, absolute cost no object, state of the art, you know. Sure, I'd love to know what that would have been like. But to go more vintage than that, I think Pioneer has a very famous receiver, the something or other 1984, that puts out, I forgot, like 300 watts per channel or something crazy for a receiver. I would love to check that out with powering a pair of Klipshorns. That would be
There you go.
Fun day.
Dallas Dave asks, will there be a future-proof portable player in your view? DTS, HD, Master Audio, Dolby True HD, Pono, perhaps? The Pono might very well be... a great high-res player. Mark Waldrop at AIX Records and David Chesky, also from Chesky Records and HD Tracks, both just extol the virtues of this new smartphone called the M8 from HTC, which is capable of reproducing 192 kilohertz 24-bit audio, stereo audio, or I think 9624 multi-channel. And they're both blown away by it. And it's a smartphone. So I'm actually going to try and get my hands on one. I'm an iPhone kind of guy, but it's going to be worth checking this phone out, I think, definitely. What about you, Mark? Any portable players in your viewer?
Well, I actually bought a Samsung Galaxy Tab Pro 8.4 as my portable player. I don't know if the software that I installed is actually delivering 2496 or 2492. It plays the files.
But maybe it down converts them.
Yeah, well, I don't know. There's not a lot of information there. I can tell you that I don't care because it is powerful enough to drive my headphones, and that's what really matters in my view, is the quality of the preamplification or amplification, just to be able to drive whatever transducer you're connecting to it. And I chose that because it was a nice multi-purpose device that happened to also sound very good with all the headphones that I had. So I could stop dragging around a little portable headphone amp, which is what I had been doing beforehand. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing special or audiophile about it. Just a question of having tried a few tablets and concluding that it had enough juice to do what I needed to.
To do what you wanted it to do. Yeah.
And the fact is, the vast majority of my music is downloaded from iTunes, and I make fun of me, whoever wants to. I can't hear the difference. 256K MP3, 320 kilobit MP3 versus CD. I can't hear that difference. I can't hear the difference between that and SACD. Maybe I'm lucky. Maybe, it's good to be in your 40s. I used to be able to hear those things that scare seagulls away, and now, those devices are silent to me.
Yeah, you used to be able to hear, what is it called, the bumblebee ringtone that kids use?
So the mosquito tone.
Yes. Mosquito tone, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Tucker in the chat room is asking, what's the best way to break in a plasma? Break-in slides? Now, this is a pretty good question. And there are a lot of, I think on AVS even, there's a program that you can download that somebody put together that has a series of break-in slides. I personally don't think it's necessary, because burn-in and image retention are not nearly what they used to be, not the problems they used to be. So if you simply watch full screen HD TV, in the first 100 hours or so, you limit yourself mostly to that. Doesn't have to be exclusive. You don't have to be anal about it. But, if you were to watch nothing but, letterboxed movies with black bars on the top and bottom for the first 100 hours, yeah, you'd get some ghosting in those letterbox areas. Or if you watch nothing but news channels with a scrolling ticker across the bottom, that might cause some image retention problems. But if you just watch regular HD TV, and different channels, because the channels also have these little bugs that stay in one corner or another. If you just switch around and watch different stuff for the first 100 hours and don't crank up the contrast, keep the contrast, at a moderate level, then I don't think you need break-in slides. Would you agree, Mark?
I do agree. The break-in slides are, I think, for somebody who is bound for a professional calibration as soon as they can get to it, because the argument is reasonable to age all the phosphors to the point where they become relatively stable, and they'll a professional calibration will take and not drift, and you don't want just the potential of, I just accidentally watched a bunch of content that was really blue shifted, or I don't know. But I would agree that unless that was your goal, that you were just in this really big rush to get to that professional calibrator through your door, then you should really just watch regular content and not worry about it at all.
Yep, Yep. Hey, Sentinel in the chat room. Finally, we get a Dolby Atmos question. I was hoping to get one of these. Sentinel in the chat room asks, does anyone know if the Dolby Atmos home receivers are using different hardware, or can a firmware update enable a 9-channel Yamaha amp, for example, to have Atmos support? The answer is no. As far as I know, and we only know a little bit about Dolby Atmos at home at this point, but as far as I know, you do need one of the new receivers from Pioneer, Onkyo, Integra, soon to be from Denon and Marantz as well, that have Dolby Atmos decoder chips in them. So I'm pretty sure it's a hardware thing. Mark, did you get to hear the Dolby Atmos demos at CE Week?
I did not.
No. You did not. That's a shame. I wish you had.
Can't speak to it.
You've only heard it in theaters, I guess, right?
I only heard it in theaters, exactly.
Right. And what's your impression of it from the theater?
Well, that it certainly delivers what's promised. I mean, the ceiling is the least paid attention to part of many home theaters to begin with, acoustically. Right. It should be treated, but it's also a surface that can provide a new dimension of sound.
Where sound can come from. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. A lot of movies that I like to watch have a lot of action and could genuinely benefit from that flyover or whatever effects that can bring you out of that circle, that plane that you're usually listening to.
Yep. I couldn't agree more. There are over 100 movies that have been mixed with Dolby Atmos soundtracks. None of them are available on Blu-ray with Dolby Atmos soundtracks yet, but that will come in the fall. Will start being re-released. And of course, then you have to buy your favorite movies all over again if you want. It's like, oh man, I got to buy the White Album again. But not only do you need the content, you need the Blu-ray with Dolby Atmos soundtrack encoded on it. And the good news there is that any Blu-ray player will work, and the current Blu-ray standard will work. You can put a Dolby Atmos soundtrack on a currently existing Blu-ray, no problem. But you do need a new AV receiver or preamp processor and some new speakers. Either add speakers on the roof, on the ceiling rather, like as in a theater, but that has a very low spousal acceptance factor. So Dolby very wisely specified something else, an alternative, which is to take your front speakers, front left and right, and your rear surround left and right, and put upward firing speakers on top of them so that the sound bounces off the ceiling and it's as if you had speakers up there, but you don't actually have to put speakers up there. Now, Pioneer has made some new speakers, and in fact Andrew Jones, the designer of those speakers, is going to be on this very show next week to talk about them, so I won't say too much about them now when I ask him a bit more about them, but they've made a new set of speakers with exactly that, these new drivers that point upward. You can also buy, I believe Onkyo makes or will make them, a Triad, I think, as well, little speakers, little box speakers that you simply put on top of your main speakers, and they fire upward. But you do need a separate receiver or pre-pro that is Dolby Atmos capable in order to do that.
And I'm going to go way out on a limb and just say that someday they will also figure out how to replicate a concert hall and not just, you know, and actually that multi-channel music can truly be realized by having that height information, because I've never been in a live venue that, you know, had like an 8-foot ceiling. It's always a part of that ambient sensation.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally agree. And maybe those stupid, hall, jazz, church settings in AV receivers that no one ever uses might actually have some benefit now if they're in an Dolby Atmos receiver. I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily bet on it, but, you know, what the hell? Harper in the chat room is saying Meridian and Sentrance make popular DACs. And he's pointing to HeadFi's DAC section. And that was another website I was going to bring up. And thank you for reminding me. HeadFi, head-fi.org, is another headphone website, but they have a lot of coverage on DACs. So I would definitely go there as well. head-fi.org/product/category/DACs. But if you go to head-fi.org and look for DACs, you will find them. And they're very good. Jude Mancilla is the guy there, and he has also been on my show and really knows his stuff quite a bit. Twilight Linkable is going to send me some pics of his system. So, okay, we'll see if that works. Da Vinci Wonder says, but you were only fooled in the hallway when it was from a single source, the doorway. He's talking about that story I told about walking by the Wilson Audio Room at a hi-fi show and being fooled into thinking it was live. That's exactly correct. Had I been in the room, well, I wouldn't have been fooled because I would have seen that there were no musicians in there. Part of it was the sighted factor, but also the fact that it was coming through a bunch of people, through a door, into a hallway that was also crowded with a bunch of people. So not the best testing environment, that's for sure. Microstamp asks, do you know why Netflix streaming movies look all washed out and oversaturated on my 50-inch plasma? Normal TV or DVD watching looks great. Mark, you spent a lot of time with streaming. Any ideas on this one?
And we're talking about watching on the same device.
Yeah, it looks like it.
In all likelihood, Netflix screwed up the transfer and maybe set the video levels wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
have you found
range.
That to be very common, that streaming services kind of screw things up?
Yes, I've definitely seen movies that have washed out blacks and absolutely should not have. It's not that common. I've never seen it on a new release of a studio film, but back catalog, anything goes.
I
definitely see that.
Web7092 has posted a question for you, but they're using your name, Mark Henninger. And if you want to get Mark's attention, you really should use his screen name, IMAGIC, iMagic. But the question is, have you tried WebOS on the latest LG smart TVs? I haven't.
I have not tried an LG smart TV at all.
I did see WebOS at CE Week. You and I, in fact, did an interview with one of the LG guys there, and he showed us the web, what's it called? WebOS.
Yes, he did.
And it looked pretty good to me. I thought it actually looked pretty nice. Now, I don't have any great experience with it, so I can't say for sure, but on casual inspection, I thought it looked pretty good. Morpheus XP asks, I've noticed a few retailers have either really slimmed down or even killed their 3D Blu-ray sections. Is 3D in the home dead already? Tough question. Vizio has removed 3D from all of its 2014 TVs. And yet 3D continues to be made. And it continues to appear in the theaters quite a bit. I just saw a preview screening of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, which was 3D, but it was shot in 3D. It wasn't post-converted. And I thought it looked fabulous. And Mark, I think you've been a fan of 3D for a while, haven't you?
I am. And what I find is whenever I see a better iteration of it, it reinvigorates me a little bit. And yes, more recent movies... I've seen some good examples of it, but I don't crave it the way I did when it first came out, and it really seemed novel. So I kind of feel like I could live without it and would concentrate on other image quality parameters. But if it's there and it hasn't been totally taken away, then I would indulge in it sometimes. And I hope that continues to be the case because with most TVs, at least with active 3D glasses, which I don't love, at least I understand that it's just a matter of putting a little transmitter and not having to put a filter over the whole screen like what I preferred, which was passive 3D. So hopefully it'll be retained as a feature because it's out there. It's on Netflix. It's on Vudu. It's on Blu-ray. And there are only going to be more movies and more content that do use it. Sometimes it's fun. But yeah, it's no longer like, I mean, 2.5 years ago, I bought a TV because it was going to be an awesome 3D TV. I mean,
right.
And that's that notion is gone. I'm just glad it's, you know, it's still a decent TV at this point.
Harper in the chat room is saying Astell and Kern does a good portable player. And that's true. I had forgotten that one. Thanks, Harper. Astell and Kern, Astell and Kern. They do a very good, a high-res portable player. So that's excellent there. Web2380 says, I've gone full circle and prefer good, clean 2.1. Full circle from surround to 2.1. I like that. Twilight Linkable here has updated a little bit. TV input for cable box only. Digital input for everything else coming out of my TV. When I turn on the digital input for Blu-ray, there's no audio-video desync issue. When I keep digital input on and switch back to my cable box, I will see a desync in the audio from the video. It sounds to me like, are you connecting everything into your TV and then coming out from the TV's optical out? That's not generally the way I recommend doing things if that's the way you're doing it. Because I suppose the TV could have lip sync issues. Let's see. Oh, interesting though. Is it the cable box? When I keep the digital input and switch back to the cable box, CD sync. Ah, okay. So it's the cable box that is not synced. Everything coming out of the TV is synced, if I understand you correctly. So that would mean that either there's something wrong with the cable box, or possibly that input on the sound system. In any event, this may not solve any problem for you, but if your Pioneer sound system has multiple HDMI inputs or multiple inputs of any sort, I would use that as the switcher and send just one signal to the TV. I don't know if you have a receiver or a home theater in a box or what it is, but we're starting to focus in on this. Web 9965, Sennheiser 414s must have tossed them when the foam deteriorated. Call me stupid. Well, I would never call you stupid, but Sennheiser 414s are great headphones. Twilight Linkable, here's a simple one for you. If money was not an issue, what would you recommend for watching movies and listening to music? Well, Mark, I think if money were no issue, watching movies probably would be Kaleidoscape, wouldn't it?
As a source?
Yeah.
That, as of today, yeah, that's a... Sure, money no issue, great option. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially if you don't care about 3D, because that's one of its main limitations. No 3D.
Ah, they don't
Blu-ray
do 3D.
Playback
okay.
At all. Right. But, you know... A large catalog of actual Blu-ray downloads until somebody comes up with a 4K movie store, that's the highest quality you can get and not have to, you know, leave your home. I mean, really, to be able to buy the stuff. I'm much more of a fan of instant gratification, so I could be pretty critical of that product as well.
Instant gratification. I mean, once you download it, it's in the server. It's Kaleidoscape is basically a Blu-ray server, and it plays exactly the same copies of Blu-rays, not low bitrate streams or anything like that. It's exactly what you would see on a Blu-ray, but it's all organized in a hard disk server.
Absolutely. And the fact that there is even as a store where you can order those things and be watching the movie that same night is actually pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I get into a lot of trouble for my desire for actual instant gratification, which leads me to the streaming services. But yeah, as of today, there's no substitute for Blu-ray if you're quality focused about your home theater watching.
And then in terms of a display, if money is no object, I would probably say if you can build money's really no object, build your own room and put a projector and a big screen in there and you will have a true cinematic experience. Mark, you were going to say something.
I was going to say private IMAX, definitely.
There you go. Money no object. Private IMAX. I say yay.
You can spend IMAX. $5 million and
Man, and that would be awesome. I think TCL is related to that somehow, aren't they? I don't remember exactly how.
They're going to build a private IMAX in a box for $250,000, whereas up until now, it's been a multi-million dollar proposition. So.
$250,000, where's my wallet? Web9965 makes a good point. Make your plasma last by setting it to its lowest power output, that is, not dynamic or vivid mode, and occasionally running the scrolling screen burn protection. Yeah, that's not bad advice. Virtually all plasmas have this burn-in eraser, image retention eraser, which basically scrolls a black bar on a white background and kind of exercises all the pixels equally. And I do certainly agree with not putting it in dynamic or vivid mode, but rather movie mode, if nothing else, or custom mode and have it fully calibrated. Jim Four, how can you improve your sound, surround sound, not using just the Samsung 55-inch 3D TV? Well, if you're using the internal audio from the Samsung 55-inch TV, just about anything will improve the sound. A soundbar, for example. Mark, you just reviewed a Vizio soundbar that actually had physical surround speakers in the back and a subwoofer. Certainly, that is better than the TV's internal sound, wouldn't you say?
It's a lot better than the TV's internal sound. And although I'm not going to recommend it for a music lover, having actual surround speakers does a better job of creating a movie experience than any soundbar with fake surround that I've heard. So, you know, the front stage isn't as expansive as it should be, but the surround definitely creates that large enveloping, like, you know, again, if a scene calls for it, you're watching some kind of a Transformers or something, you hear that sphere of, you know, of sound, and you can place where things are going on. I mean, even with an expensive soundbar. I also think that the fact that movies, they demand a lot of dynamic range, but usually the peaks are very quick and transient. So I was actually surprised at how well, like, the small subwoofer was able to basically keep up. And again, I'm contrasting it to music, where, like, just a bass line can just crush, you know, a little subwoofer like that. But if all it has to do is reproduce a couple of crunches, it gets by. So it gets better than what I've heard in... I mean, there's just, and it's even more true today than it's been in the past. TVs in the slimming process have lost having any space for speakers, except for, I think, a couple of Sony models that people are then critical of the aesthetics of having front-facing speakers. But yeah,
right.
Except for a couple of exceptions, at this point, the speakers don't even face forward and they're tiny, and there's no hope for... I think Bang & Olufsen would be the only other company I could point to where that's really building televisions where the speakers themselves are still a focus, you know, in terms of quality.
Right. And then, of course, the next step up from a soundbar system, even one with separate surround speakers, would be a true surround sound system. And Web 0765 asks, I have an ST60, congratulations, Panasonic ST60, very nice plasma. Was wondering, for under $500, what's a good surround sound system? My first answer to that immediately is the current Pioneer speakers designed by Andrew Jones. They make a bookshelf and a floor stander, a center channel, and a subwoofer, which is a modest subwoofer, to say the least. We'll call that the weakest part of the system. But for like $500, it's incredible. It punches easily three or four times that amount beyond its price class. So you still need an amplifier, a receiver, but you can get if you can spend $1,000, $500 for the speakers, another $500 for the receiver. You can probably get by with less on the receiver, maybe $300. I wouldn't go much below that, though. you'd have a kick-ass sound system. I love those Andrew Jones speakers from Pioneer. The new ones, the Atmos ones, are going to be quite a bit more expensive. Still not outrageous, but compared to the ones that are currently on the website, and go to, you know, pioneerelectronics.com and look up speakers and look up their home theater speakers, they are a killer value. Mark, have you ever heard those inexpensive Pioneers?
I have a bunch of them in my house.
Oh yeah, that's true. You've got the floor standers, right?
It's not my current surround system because I replaced them with basically PA speakers, much higher efficiency. But I have four of the towers. I have the center channel, and I have the bookshelves. So, yeah, you could even do the center channel and a four bookshelf system with a $300 AVR, and that would come in right around $650 or $700. And yeah, I would say it would be incredibly difficult to beat that. You know, add just a well shopped for subwoofer, maybe or maybe not Pioneers, then you'd be under $1,000 and really cranking. And hey, yeah, the towers are quite awesome. I mean, I'd even recommend them to a two-channel music fan. I mean, they have real audiophile elements to their, you know, to the way they create sound.
Right, exactly so. Rusty Bones. I like the Cathedral Cave Jazz Club setup. Yeah, well, if you like, you know, to each their own, I always say. Web7939 is asking, I'm deciding between a curved or flat projector screen. What would you recommend? My basement is well light controlled. Budget is $1,500. It depends in part on the size of the screen. But for $1,500, I wouldn't get a curved screen. For one thing, most curved screens typically come with auto masking systems. Stuart Film Screens is called CineCurve and Director's Choice. I mean, you can do it, but curvature to me is really only beneficial on really, really big screens. And this brings up a huge topic that Mark, you and I have talked about a lot, which is the insistence of some TV makers, Samsung and LG in particular, Samsung more so even than LG, to make curved televisions. And at 55 inches and 65 inches, which I think is ridiculous. It's not necessary at all. In fact, it's detrimental, in my opinion.
CNET had a big blaring headline, curved is entirely a gimmick or something like that on their review of the latest Samsung, which was kind of what I thought the headline was going to be once Katzmeier got through looking at it. Curves make sense for really big screens because the shallow focus depth of a projector means that the screen needs to be the same distance from the lens. And on a giant movie theater screen, that means that the edges of the screen are several feet further back than the center, unless the screen itself is curved, and that would be out of focus.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And it would lead to optical distortion as well.
Yes. In the home, it's just inches and everything. I mean, I've seen plenty of flat screens. Everything's in focus, edge to edge. So if that's not the issue, then yeah, it's kind of a waste of money. And you'd be better off getting a better screen material, just something more focused to your environment, whether it's gain or metallic or, you know, polarized for 3D. I would look for some other quality, to spend the money on, and yeah, then that curve.
Yeah, I agree. Now, he says the basement is well light controlled. The question, though, is what are the colors of the walls and ceiling and floor? If they are dark neutral gray or even black, my favorite screen is the Stuart Studio Tech 100, which is a Unity Gain white screen. But it requires an absolute black hole room with black walls, black ceiling, or dark gray anyway, black floor. If you have that, if you have a spouse understanding enough to let you have that, as I do, The StudioTek 100 is a gorgeous looking screen, but it's pretty limited. Otherwise, you probably want to go with a slight bit of gain. 1.3 is typical. Stuart StudioTek 130 is the classic example, but other companies make them as well. And depending on the size, I think you can get in for $1,500, no problem. So let's see here. NLE guy says, I have a 3% visible burn-in on my 2013 50-inch Samsung from my Shaw Direct receiver, only visible on a full black image. Is it removable? Depends on if it's what's called image retention, which is temporary, or burn-in, which is permanent. And as we talked about earlier, I don't remember the Samsung. You just got a Samsung Plasma, Mark. Does it have a screen burn or a screen wipe feature in it? Have you found that?
Oh, yeah. There's definitely a wipe function. Use it if you see a little bit of retention. Let it go overnight.
Exactly.
In the old days, they would recommend playing static, but... over-the-air antenna is required.
Right, and a tuner that can be tuned in between channels.
Mm-hmm, to a static channel, yeah. But, the wipe does... I mean, there's nothing else to do. And the more you run a program like that, the more likely you'll be able to recover from an image retention issue.
Yep. Totally agree. Effin Dunn says, hey, do you remember the old days of overscan? I used to consider it bonus content on my studio monitors.
Evidently, all the TV makers remember it because they include it and they set all their TVs with it on.
Yeah, it's like, what's going on there? It's true. The TVs all include overscan, which basically what it is it's taking the image, scaling it up slightly, zooming in slightly digitally, essentially, and cropping off a little bit of the edges. Why do they do that? It doesn't make any sense. I always say, when you buy a new TV, go in, find the overscan control, whatever it is, turn it off. Because you lose resolution because of the scaling. You lose some of the picture around the edge. So it's really not a good thing. So let's see, NLE guy, Netflix problem resides in the video level on computer not matching video level like Western Digital Player crushing black on MKV and MP4 files. Well, that's a very good point. The difference between video black and computer black, they aren't the same. And so if you don't have things set up properly with what the signal is coming in and what the display is displaying, you could end up exactly with that problem of a mismatch of whites and blacks, but it becomes more of a problem, I think, in the blacks. Let's see. Twilight Linkable says, I'm going to have to tweet your video on Twitter. Do I have a Twitter handle? I do. It's HTGeekScott. But also, and perhaps more important, is the Twitter handle AVS Forum. Which, Mark, you manage that, and I'm very glad that you do.
Yep, I tweet out all our stories.
Mm-hmm. And Web 79. Sorry?
Okay, at AVS Forum, is it?
That's it. I will mention that again at the end. And Web 7092 says, could you give your opinion on which display technology will be able to support 12-bit or greater video precision? Great question. I hope and long for 12-bit and greater bit depth, because that will allow high dynamic range to be displayed without banding, without when you see minor transitions between one shade and another of a particular color, especially in the low end of the brightness range, then you start seeing these bands of solid color and it looks weird. You increase the bit depth and that goes away. As to which technology is better at it, can't say that I know. Any of them should be able to do it. Certainly LCD can do it. Plasma doesn't matter anymore. OLED, I'm sure, can do it. Don't know about DLP. I'm sure it can. It's just a matter of the processing and the electronics to support the greater bit depth. Dolby Vision, which is Dolby's version of high dynamic range, uses 12 bits, or would like to anyway. Their early demos might be 10 bit. Certainly the Vizio demo was 10 bit. But I don't think there's a limitation on it in terms of which technology you use. Unless, Mark, do you have any other thought on that?
Well, I guess LCDs have the brightness, but other technologies, direct emission LEDs, I think, is what we'd like to see, because there you can go beyond OLED in terms of ultimate brightness and still have the ultimate blacks. But that's not a technology I expect to come to market. I mean, just looking at the price of what LG is going to have to charge for an OLED, I don't think there's going to be room for another technology to try to get there.
I agree.
I'm a big proponent of high bit depths. Banding is a very distracting artifact. And I've been shooting HDR photos for a long time now, but we've had to use what's called tone compression to just be able to display them on regular monitors. In other words, you're catching the information, but you're bringing it back into the Rec 709 gamut and dynamic range. I would love to see displays that expand beyond that and can truly show that content properly. But I would be the most enthusiastic to see OLED succeed, maybe have get a bit more peak brightness out of the technology while preserving longevity. I mean, it looks like it's where plasma was when plasma was beginning, with the relatively short lifespans and limitations that were, I think with all TV technologies get surmounted.
Get better with age as they get developed and refined. I agree.
But it's really easy to see that LED is going to get there first, and that the only hope for LED TVs to really have a great quality would be true full array local dimming on IPS panels, which would mean that you would have a very wide viewing range and still the ability to get deep blacks that are very localized.
Well, shall we say relatively wide viewing angles?
Relatively, it especially
never match with plasma.
Yeah, and even it's funny in the two plasmas that I've dealt with over the past few weeks, I ended up with a Samsung F8500, but even it has the louver filters on it that try to reduce the ambient light coming off the screen for daylight viewing, and that actually limits its vertical viewing angles. I really appreciate it in a dark room. The cheaper F5300 plasma that I had that has no filter on the screen, but there was no angle where it wasn't completely, it was always the exact same image, just distorting because you were looking at it from a side angle geometrically, but never a shift in color at all. So yeah, a pure, call it naked plasma, has the best viewing angles. And in fact, OLED has problems with maintaining the, as far as I gather, color accuracy at angles. I mean, it maintains its contrast and its saturation, but it discolors. So yeah, nothing will beat plasma, an unfiltered plasma for viewing angles.
Yep. Web 1964 asks, thoughts on Faroujia. Is their stuff worth the money? Well, Faroujia used to make very high-end video processors. They don't anymore, and they have them for a long time. And they were really more geared towards CRT-based projectors, which are now dinosaurs. So, that's not, I don't think that's really something that you need to think about much these days. Now, what Faroujia is doing these days, he has moved on. Yves Faroujia, he was a guest on my show a couple months ago, I think now. And he is working on a system whereby he can take a digital video stream and reduce the bit rate that is required to transmit it without reducing the picture quality. And it's really quite ingenious. I mean, the guy's a genius. And if you haven't watched that, pardon me. If you haven't watched that episode, I recommend you do, because he's a very smart guy. And what he's doing with this video bitrate reduction is very interesting. But that's not going to be something you can buy. Maybe somebody will put it into an external box. But for the most part, it's going to be a chip that gets built into devices. So that's about all I would say about that. F and Dunn says distance from the screen should be considered too. Always. You should always consider distance from screen. And if you're, I think this goes back to the curved versus flat screen question. And certainly if you're sitting really close to the screen and you're right in the center, then a curved screen could give you a greater sense of immersion.
Oh, you got me thinking.
Well, yeah.
You know, in my recent experience with 4K TVs, it's very nice to get close and scrutinize it. But it's also true that all of these are LCDs, and I've happened to notice that when you're relatively close to an LCD and it's using a vertically aligned panel, then the contrast actually drops off right when you're looking at it, even if you're squared up directly against it. So the one situation where the curve works in that context is if you're using a TV as a computer monitor and it's LCD based, just to prevent that viewing angle effect, you know, from taking hold. So it actually does solve a flaw in LCD's performance.
In terms of being a computer monitor.
In terms of, because you have to go far enough back and be centered to watch a television, an LCD television, especially a vertically aligned one, to have the image actually have proper full uniformity. The closer you get, the more the edges of the TV are actually off angle. And some of these TVs that have like a 10 degree or 20 degree viewing cone, you know, you just get relatively close to the screen enough to be able to see that 4K and the edges of the screen are washing out. If it's
good
flat.
Point. Yeah. Excellent. We're out of time here, so let's see if we can get one more question in. Sandblaster is saying, with the summer heat, I need to run my window air conditioner. Any way to mask the sound with my receiver in the room without noise canceling headphones? Boy, not that I know of, unless you were to have some sort of noise canceling box. Hey, here's a great Kickstarter project. A little box that has a microphone in it and either a speaker or an output to your receiver that adds a phase inverted, whatever is coming into the microphone, phase inverts it, sends it out, adds it to the sound that is coming out of your speakers from your TV, would work just like noise-canceling headphones. I don't really know if that would work, but got me thinking.
I've read that they're working on localized noise cancellation for restaurants. I mean, just happens to my wife.
Oh, wouldn't that be a great idea? Your wife is a food critic, right?
Yeah, and there's research in the technology because a lot of restaurants have overhead speakers that you would be able to do to aim noise cancellation at individual tables and create bubbles of quiet.
Wow, wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, so I would imagine that any such research, and I'm sure it's being done for other things like car interiors and stuff, that you could apply that also, of course, to an air conditioner in a room.
Yeah. Just around the corner from our house is a new wine and tapas bar that we walked up to the other night, my wife and I, just to get a glass of wine and have a couple nibbles. And it's a delightful place, but it's too loud. All the surfaces are hard, concrete, glass. And they tried putting up some sound baffling in one part of the room, but it didn't really work. So my wife and I were thinking, how could we offer our services to make this a quieter place? And maybe this would be one thing to do. let's see. Oh, it does exist, NLE guy says. You put a puck in the window. I don't know what that is. I'll have to go look into that. That would be a really cool thing. Well, you know what? We've come to the end of an hour. It seems like it's only been a few minutes. But we've been chattering away here for an hour and answered a bunch of questions. I think it's been great. Thanks, Mark, so much for being here with me.
Time did fly, and it's really a ton of fun.
Amazing. <Thank you>. You know, I'm thinking about doing this on a regular basis. I don't know exactly how often, but a regular basis. Every once in a while. I'd love to have you come back, Mark, and we'll just do this again. What do you say?
I'm game. That would be awesome.
Cool, man. So, of course, you can contact Mark and me both at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And as I said earlier, you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, and you can follow Mark at avsforum. Now, you can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg, and also on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/home-theater-geeks. As I mentioned earlier, next week my guest geek will be Andrew Jones, the world-renowned speaker designer who just came up with Pioneer's new Dolby Atmos speakers. And so I'm going to be asking him about what that involved, what are the parameters that he needed to think about, what's this Dolby Atmos thing at home all about. So I do hope you will join me for that because it should be great. Until then, oh, and before I leave, I almost said it, but before I leave, I want to also make sure you all know that I will be filling in for Leo Laporte on the Tech Guy radio show this Saturday and Sunday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific time. It'll be on the radio. Go to techguylabs.com to find a station near you. Or tune in live at live.twit.tv and be sure to join the chat room, which I will be monitoring during the show. So until all of that, geek out.